Talk given Saturday, March 24th, 1973. You may recall that last time we touched upon certain very important points in connection with the Upanishadic teachings regarding Brahman and Atma, which are the two key words of the Upanishads. They represent, let us remind ourselves again, realized transcendence. Therefore, they represent man's living experience as and when the one total reality comes to self-consciousness through the individual who is completely purified and wholly unresisting to reality. We also considered the meaning of the word the person, the Purusha, the one in whom all evil-mindedness is burnt out. That is the real meaning of the word the person, the one in whom all evil-mindedness is burnt out. I quoted certain passages in which Yajnavalkya, one of the greatest of the Upanishadic teachers, speaks about the inner controller, as the Atman is called, and also that very magnificent passage in the Brihadaranyaka where he talks of the imperishable. We also compared with that, compared not in the sense of comparison, but saw it side by side, the statement of the Buddha in that famous autobiographical discourse of his, the Ariya Paryesana Sutta, in which he talks of seeking the unborn, the unaging, undecaying, undying, the sorrowless, the stainless. And we took similar passages from the oldest of the Upanishads, the pre-Buddhistic Upanishads, where the Atma is presented precisely in that form, the unborn, the unaging, the undying, thirstless, hungerless, sorrowless, stainless. And that is something upon which everyone who is seriously concerned with the deeps of religion should meditate upon very carefully. Because if one really sees into the truth, one will see that there is absolutely no reason for the orthodox, conventional Buddhist and Hindu worlds to quarrel with one another over this teaching about the Atma. This unborn, unaging, undying, the uttermost security from the bonds, nirvana, as the Buddha said, is identical with what the Upanishads presented as the Atma. Now, I feel that today it would be helpful to all of us to spend some time in periods of meditation. I could go on expounding hour after hour, week after week, but that's not much use. There is a superficial impression created. There is perhaps even a deep impression upon the individual. But it is only in so far as one's inner sensitivity is activated to the highest possible extent that it can function. And that inner sensitivity grasps what the scriptures place before us, that there is real realization of the truth. Realization of the truth is something totally different from an intellectual grasp of it. The ordinary intellectual grasp of anything whatsoever is terribly spoiled, distorted, made inadequate by all our conditioning, by our moral state, and by all the intellectual conditioning that we have had from the moment we are born, and which, of course, is an inescapable conditioning. One is born in a family, in a society, under certain circumstances, at a certain time in history. One has one's socio-cultural heritage and all the rest of it, so the conditioning is inevitably there. No one can escape that, whether he be the perfected Holy One or just an ordinary person like myself. We all have to go through that. Therefore, in order that the religious side of our nature may truly come to fruition, and also because we cannot just get rid of that conditioning at a stroke, we have to allow this deep sensitivity that lies within the hidden recesses of the mind to come out. And that sensitivity is still something which is pure and beautiful and wonderful. And it has a sort of a capacity for an unerring, omniscient at-one-ment with the truth which the religions try to present. I say try to present because no verbal presentation can ever be anything like the reality. So now, meditation is a very important thing. And the usual conception of meditation is that it is a specific something, a technique in which you spend 5 minutes, 5 hours, or whatever it is every day to go through a particular process. That unquestionably is one aspect of meditation. It is the aspect of meditation in its very early stages, almost a kindergarten stage as such. And perhaps one of the main values of that type of meditation is that it enables this inner sensitivity to grow. It is the sensitizing of our mind. But the set technique of meditation also produces a fixed conditioning. The mind is conditioned to function thus and thus and thus. It is not left free. That inward freedom, which is the ultimate state of freedom, because pure consciousness by itself is utterly free. It has no concepts attached to it at all. That final freedom comes after one has released this sensitivity, understood that it is accompanied with a certain degree of conditioning, and the release from that conditioning comes because one has developed the capacity to let go all concepts, all ideas, all beliefs, all convictions. Because in the profoundest stages of meditation, that is precisely what happens to the Holy One who is in the state of meditation. Now, in that state of meditation, meditation comes into its own, which means that one is in complete communion. The one total reality, the whole thing, good, bad, indifferent, nothing is left out. The one total reality comes to full self-awareness. The full self-awareness which is possible for it to come through in the individual being. That is that state of communion, which is the state of meditation. This is the meaning of samadhi. The complete, total togetherness. Sam-sang-adhi, the topmost, the perfect, complete togetherness, oneness. The unity is released. Not a uniformity, but the true unity in which the multitudinous particulars which compose this unity, as far as your consciousness, your awareness is concerned, are all in total relationship with each other. Complete relationship. And that is the meaning of harmony. Whatever the relationships may be, they may be pleasant, they may be painful, they may be both together. That's neither here nor there. Never imagine that religious fulfillment means the pleasurable, the utterly desirable. Far from it. This is a very hard pill to swallow. But this overriding harmony of the universe means a universal harmony in which energy, the total energy of the universe, functions in all sorts of ways, which to us as living organisms can be extremely troublesome and painful in certain instances and quite pleasant and agreeable in other instances. You see, man as he lives burns away. Life is a process of burning away. Understand that burning away as the true dying away. Now, if I burn away selflessly, understanding that this burning process is in line with the universal process around me, then I live purely. And living purely, I die transcendentally. I die out of time into eternity, from moment to moment. I die out of limited existence and functioning into the infinite all, in consciousness, mind you. The body, of course, just remains the body, 6 feet 2 inches high and no more. And that's all. Now, meditation lies at the heart of all this. The state of meditation, which means the state of communion. This total communion. Refusing nothing, grasping at nothing. But being completely unresisting, infinitely resilient to the free flow of universal energy and life, which means transcendence. And there is the culmination of religious living. A culmination which remains perpetual with one, as long as one lives. Right. Now, you all know this wonderful little statement about the Atma. Neti, neti. Not this, not this. Nothing can describe it. The infinite cannot be put into the small box of description. For the very simple reason that the box of description has a particular and limited size. But the Atma is the infinitely small as well as the infinitely large. Which part of the box will contain the Atma then? None whatever. If the Atma is the infinitely small, It goes through that box exactly as a neutrino just goes right through the earth and right through the universe without let or hindrance. And if it's infinitely large, the poor box, its life ends like the, we'll put it in a nice way, like the life of the butterfly at the end of the day. And that's the end of our box of description. So, neti, neti, not this, not this. The Atma is not this, it is not that. It is unseizable, for it is not seized. It is indestructible, for it is not destroyed. It is unattached, for it does not attach itself. It is unbound. It does not tremble. It is not injured. The statements as they stand sound quite simple and childlike. And one may say, especially if I am very profound philosopher in a university or some such thing, oh, what on earth is there in this? Why anybody could say these things? They mean nothing at all. They mean so much that my professorhood can never grapple with them. Let us look at them a bit. It is unseizable, for it is not seized. The great teaching of non-grasping is involved here. Who can seize hold of the absolute, of the infinite, the immeasurable? Isn't that one of the great mistakes we make? To chase God? Like the hungry lover chases the beloved in order to possess the beloved and grasp it. And therefore, love is spelt with a simple L and not a capital L, in fact. No, you can't do it that way. Not seized. It is here, it is everlastingly here. In me, through me, outside me, around me. In fact, so much is it here that I am not. You see, the I is completely out. There is only the Atma. And therefore, I cannot seize it, even if I wanted. It is indestructible, for it is not destroyed. It is self-existent, therefore. The absolute is. The incomprehensible, the inconceivable, infinite, about which no words can be said, no thoughts can be thought. It doesn't come into being, it doesn't grow, it doesn't proceed, it doesn't die, it is not destroyed. The unborn, the unaging, the undying. It is the stainless, it has no limits. It cannot be spoilt. It is not another thing. It is not a profound conception, a wonderful deep state of consciousness, not a bit of it. This is its absoluteness. This is the meaning of the majesty, of the eternal reality. So man feels awe in the presence of the recognition, the little glimmer that we get of the real nature of this absolute. is indestructible. It is unattached, for it does not attach itself. And yet the great mystery is that the Atma is, though not attached to me, is me. It is the totality, it is the all, but it is not attached to the particulars composing that totality. It is I who see separate particulars composing a totality. The Atma just is the totality composed of innumerable particulars. This is its marvel. Can the intellect grasp it? No. Don't try to. Let this sensitivity go out in complete selfless dedication and giving of itself. This is the meaning of dying to the reality. You burn away into the reality. And this burning is a light. It's a thing of life and health, well-being, wholeness, holiness. So it is not attached, for it does not attach itself. It is unbound. Nothing limits it. It is freedom itself. Complete freedom. And it is so free that no such thing as desires, likes, predilections afflict it. It is the absolute all. Therefore it never can get concerned with, oh, I can do what I like. I am free. The one who is in the state of I can do what I like is the one who is the slave of license plus ignorance, total ignorance. But the one who knows that I never want to do what I like, but to allow to happen that which the universal process will put in the pathway of my life. Because then, this little me, this limited me, is the bridge into eternity. You see how marvelous, how wonderful are the realities of religion. How this false misconception of self can utterly dissolve away. And the reality of being, which manifests as the becoming process, shines in the world. Otherwise, the being of a person and his becoming process is a cloudy thing, a soiled thing in time and space. It does not tremble. This is extraordinarily interesting. It's extraordinarily deep. Let us not go into it today. It will take a very long time on its own to go into this. It's not trembling. It is neither moving, nor is it static. This dynamic poise of the ultimate, of the absolute, is something which I have always found very difficult to put into words, apart from using the phrase dynamic poise. But we'll try and go into it someday. It is not injured. Draw your sword or take your explosive and attack space with it. Slash your sword about. What happens to space? Nothing. If anything does happen, it may be this, that space is filled with silent laughter, which communicates itself to all the gods and the demons of the universe. So loud is the laughter in heaven, and mighty is the cackling in hell. Through man's antics. But that is what we do do. If you look very carefully into your lives, you will find that we are all the time doing this kind of thing. We are quixotic. That's about the Atma, the famous Neti Neti statement of Yajnavalkya. Now that is something which we cannot, as we are here together and as we are in our present state, really meditate upon. But there is something else which we can deal with, and it may prove a way of deeper understanding of oneself. And that is this statement, also by Yajnavalkya. And he talks in terms of the Atma as he. The context in which this comes, remember the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad is a very, very long Upanishad, takes 100 and odd pages in print, you see. And there are several of the great discourses of Yajnavalkya in them. And this is the end point of the discourse which he gives when he is asked to expound the inner controller. And he talks of the Atma. And because the question is formulated in the subjective way, Yajnavalkya refers to the Atma as he, hence the word he comes in. He is the unseen seer, the unheard hearer, the unthought thinker, the ununderstood understander. Other than he, there is no seer, no hearer, no thinker, no understander. He is the Atma, the inner controller, immortal. Now we'll take just that and spend a few minutes in meditation on it. Now, in meditating on it, don't just start writing an essay for your PhD thesis. You see? Just let the mind be as quiet as possible, and let this inner sensitivity feel out what is the reality represented by unseen seer, unheard hearer, and so on. All right? In the true meditative state, the entire organism is in the state of harmony. That is to say, it is in the state where it does not obtrude upon this full awareness. As I suggested, we are aware with our whole being, not with a part of ourselves. It is a body-mind organism in the complete and total sense of the term. A body-mind organism. See? And the body becomes less and less obtrusive the greater, the more perfect the meditative state is. And similarly, with the psychical component of the organism, it becomes less and less obtrusive. Now, what is one of the most important factors here? The purity of the mind. This is where the fundamental basis of morality, of living the good life, in the direct, unequivocal sense of the term, putting aside all the stupid intellectual fashions which spring into being through the ages as to what constitutes and what does not constitute morality. Every one of us really knows what morality is. And it has been taught by the great teachers always in the simplest terms. The abstention from all evil doing, harming, untruthfulness, self-indulgence, grasping, trying to obtain what is not one's own, and so on and so on. You all know the simple moralities. Now, when there is that foundation there, the psyche is like a high-class violin, well-tuned. Then, meditation will bring forth the harmonies of the spirit out of that organism. Let us have no illusions about that. The pursuit of pleasures, of desires, and all the rest of it are awful obstructions to the religious life. The natural things which belong to the life process will inevitably come our way in life. And there is always a right expression for these natural things. Right in terms of time and place and mode of expression. Take the simplest thing, which is the greatest problem in human life and has been from the beginning. The question of love. Love, yes, everybody, everything. But that love has its right expression in relation to each single body and each single thing. This is our individual problem. We have to see, we have to have the sense, and our action must fulfill what we see truly. So you see, that basic morality, it sounds simple, of course. The words sound very simple. They delude one into thinking it's so easy. But live it out and see what happens. In living it out, what will happen is the release of a fountain of happiness and well-being, health. So you will see that there is neither indulgence on the one hand, nor is there repression on the other hand. Then you climb to the supreme peak of right expression. That is what happens. You don't attempt to make any compromise between indulgence and repression. Both of them are out. Right expression, perfect expression. And perfect expression always involves the perfect ascesis, asceticism. And the perfect asceticism means simply this: the putting aside of everything which is unnecessary. If you are a member of a rowing crew which has to compete with another rowing crew in a month's time, you can't go drinking and dancing and whatnot till 5 a.m. every morning and then go and row. You will get a nice cooling bath in the river if you try to. That's the meaning of asceticism. But the putting aside is not an act of repression. It gets put aside because you yourself have truly seen. And when you yourself have truly seen, then in every state of meditation, this inner sensitivity, which has grown and grown towards its fruition, enables you to be the unresisting instrument, the nexus through which the unseen seer, the unheard hearer, the ununderstood understander function freely. It's an extraordinary thing. And you will find that when that happens and keeps on happening, all our conditioning, all the little prison houses, and there are literally hundreds of them in which we live throughout our lives, all those prison walls will fall away. And you will breathe the air of heaven and know what the benediction of a pure and simple life means. Not till then. Now, there is another statement of Yajnavalkya which you might use in your meditations in connection with what we have been trying to meditate upon today. When he talks of the imperishable, the ultimate real, he says, amongst other things, it consumes no one, nothing so ever. It consumes nothing so ever. And the next line is, no one so ever consumes it. If one may suggest a thought or two in connection with this, it is this. It functions through anything and everything. But in the functioning, it does not destroy anything or any person. It transforms the thing and the person. Its eternity is implanted and manifest through the thing and the person. It consumes nothing so ever. It is endless life, life abundant, life eternal. The Chandogya Upanishad says outright, Brahman is prana, life. Obviously, not biologically only. You see? And no one so ever consumes it. That is to say, just as in our ordinary everyday life, if we have a stock of potatoes or something, as we eat them up, well, of course, we consume that lot of potatoes, as we ordinarily say. It is true that we have utilized the potatoes in a certain way, involving our eating them up. But what has actually happened? A transformation process has gone on. It's true that what we saw and had in the larder as potatoes are no longer potatoes, but all of the potato has become something else. Perhaps something very rich and strange, provided it doesn't make a difference to one's waistline. You see? That is what it is. It consumes nothing so ever. No one so ever consumes it. We cannot utilize God, use him up, so to say, for our purposes. God is neither our master nor our servant. God is. That state of nirvana, which cannot be constricted by any thought whatsoever. Now, in this connection, notice one other point. We have spoken about the purity of life, the non-obtrusiveness of the body. The health of the body, the discipline of the body, especially in systems like the yogic exercises and so forth, makes the body the right sort of instrument for meditative work. And the body does not obtrude itself when one sits for meditation. When meditation takes place as it should, the whole of the metabolic process slows down. It becomes perfectly harmonious. And in the state of the supreme samadhi, the metabolic process takes you no nearer to the death of the body. There is a perfect transformative activity. When the Buddha or any of the holy ones sat in meditation, say 7 days at a time, 7 days in this state, the supreme state, which is called the cessation in Buddhist teachings, which is called the asampranyata samadhi in the Brahmanical teachings, which is the state of the perfect unio mystica of the Christian mystic or any of the other mystics of the world and so forth. In that state, if you have sat 7 days, you are not 7 days nearer death. They have been added on to your life. During those 7 days, you have been the focus point for the free entry and outflow of transcendent energies, the energies of pure mind as such, which to us, as we are at present, are immeasurable, incomprehensible. But they are there and they work. If anybody says, "What authority have you for saying that?" The authority is simply this. Live this kind of thing and see how you yourself are transformed in consequence. You are a different person forever in the direction of growth, of fruition, of fulfillment, the change which is in line with the change which the universal process is trying to bring about through the creature called man. This is the proof of it. It's a proof which cannot be handed over to another. But if you yourself, if I myself have developed certain sensitivities and am capable of seeing, then when I see the Holy One, I know this is truly a Holy One. You can't give evidence which would be accepted in court. You can't give evidence which would satisfy your logician or your scientist in the laboratory. Cannot be done. The court, the laboratory are the wrong contexts for this kind of evidence. When you truly love, you just love, and it all happens according to the workings of transcendent love. But if you try to prove your love, then the trouble begins and you're in a mess. Just love. Then you won't be proving it. It'll be there, it will work, unseen, unheard, inconceivably. And the marvel and the beauty of life and its flowering will all be there by itself. Haven't I said before, God doesn't know he is God. All happens unconsciously. Occasionally he scratches his head and says, why on earth do these human beings not understand? I can't see. So it consumes nothing so ever. No one so ever consumes it. Take those two lines and use them in conjunction with the other statements of Yajnavalkya.